Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor for Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN, who are listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, Sheldon Hackney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, will present a speech entitled Beyond the Culture Wars. On Thursday, Bobby Knight, Indiana University basketball coach, will discuss academic standards for athletes. And on Tuesday, November 16th, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, will talk about peace in the Middle East. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include Barney and his creator, Cheryl Leach, Catherine McKinnon, an expert on violence against women, Phil Satry, the president of Harrah's Casinos, the U.S. Surgeon General, Joyce Lynn Elders, FBI Director, Louis Free, and TV producer, Norman Lear. For the convenience of our audience, transcripts and audio and video tapes of this luncheon are available. Transcripts are available for fax transmission within 2 hours of the end of the speech. Transcripts or tapes may be ordered by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, Mr. Gilbert Grosvenor of the National Geographic, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce someone in our audience today. Sharon Rockefeller is the president of WETA, a public television station serving Washington, D.C. WETA will air the National Geographic special, The Power of Water, tomorrow at 8 p.m. Sharon? I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Ken Dalecki of the Kiplinger Washington Editors. Stan Jennings of Jennings Publications and a former National Geographic Society staff member. Andy Miller of the Kansas City Star. Arthur Cranish, editor, Science Trends. Charlotte Grimes of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Adriel Bettelheim, Washington Bureau Chief, Denver Post. Burns Roper, Chairman of the Roper Organization. Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Patrick Noonan, President of the Conservation Fund. Marshall Cohen, photojournalist, and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Kenneth Blaylock of ABC News and president of the White House News Photographers Association. Jack Williams, weather editor for USA Today. Jim Slade, science editor, ABC News. Randy Schmid, science editor for the Associated Press. And I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Ebdo-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. For those of you who may believe that in addition to its many other outstanding achievements since its birth in 1888, that the National Geographic Society has come across the elixir of youth, I have to explain that today's guest is not the same Gilbert Grosvenor who was editor and president much earlier in this century. However, our speaker today, Gilbert M. Grosvenor, has inherited his grandfather's passion and the enthusiasm of his father, Melville Bell Grosvenor, for improving the quality of geography education in the United States. Mr. Grosvenor's editorship of the National Geographic from 1970 until he became the Society's 14th president in 1980 has been compared to that of his grandfather. Under his leadership, the National Geographic has steered into previously uncharted waters, including stories on communism, apartheid, famine, and the horrors of war. Geographic photographers, among the world's most talented, continue to aim their cameras at species inhabiting our globe on land and underwater with energy and imagination. But coverage today also focuses on critical social, economic, and political issues. Gilbert Grosvenor has played a major role in this diversification of the society, from a single magazine organization to a major publisher of books, other magazines, and educational materials. Using state-of-the-art computer and video disc technology to communicate new knowledge about our planet to more than 60 million readers of National Geographic publications and the many more viewers of Geographic television productions. Despite its admirable efforts, the Society has not been immune to the very changes in America and the world that it seeks to capture. A few years ago, declining growth in revenue and heavy investments in major education projects prompted Mr. Grosvenor to order layoffs of more than 2,000 employees, most in the Washington area, and to cancel publication of two annual book series aimed at young readers. But the Society appears to have weathered that storm and has rebounded. Mr. Grosvenor was born here in Washington in 1931. He graduated from Yale in 1954 and joined the staff of the Geographic that year. Writing and photography assignments for the magazine took Mr. Grosvenor around the world, including on President Eisenhower's diplomatic tour to Asia, Africa, and Europe. Mr. Grosvenor's coverage of that tour won him a National Press Photographers Association Award in 1961. The Grosvenor family has also enjoyed a long relationship with the National Press Club. I have a photo here. This is from 1956, and it shows three generations of National Geographic leaders, Gilbert H. Grosvenor, Melville Bell Grosvenor, and Gilbert M. Grosvenor, all voting as active members in the National Press Club election in 1956. Thank you to Stan Jennings for preparing that. Last month, Yasser Arafat, speaking at this podium, was asked where he thought there were areas of important common concern between Arabs and Israelis. His reply was immediate: water. As Mr. Grosvenor has found, the issue of water use and misuse is one that should concern us all. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club the President and Chairman of the Board of the National Geographic Society, Mr. Gil Grosvenor.
Thank you, Clayton. I had forgotten about that picture. But I do remember not one of the three of us voted for the same person in that election. Generation gaps even then. I'm pleased to see so many people here today. I guess it must be a slow day in Washington. Nobody's at NAFTA. Nobody's following Gore Perot. Nobody's following health care. And I'm sure nobody's following the Bobbitt case. I would like to thank you for inviting us here today, Clayton. The National Geographic Society and our two partners in this freshwater study in North America, Pat Noonan of the Conservation Fund and Robert Hirsch of the United States Geological Survey, appreciate the invitation to be here. I do hope you all instinctively reached for an empty glass of water during lunch. I couldn't convince the press club to withhold water during lunch just to give you a feel of what things will be like to come. But I see that everybody found the pitcher and this conditioned reflex. You've all filled your glasses. Today, my goal is to convince you that we cannot take fresh water for granted. Indeed, I hope to persuade you to join our Wake Up America call while we still have control of our destiny. You have agonized periodically over the last 15, 20 years about the energy crisis. The bad news that the impending water crisis is potentially more devastating than any energy crisis. The good news is that you and I can prevent that crisis with responsible conservation and preservation initiatives. Consider some facts. Unlike energy, there is a finite supply of fresh water worldwide. Unlike energy, there is no substitute. Unlike energy, life is impossible without fresh water. Like energy, quality of life in every country in the world is directly linked to its water supply. The haves flourish, the have-nots wallow in poverty and despair. Today, at least 26 countries, collectively home to some 250 million people, endure acute water shortages. At least half of those nations are relegated to third world economic status, and many others thrive only because they are rich in oil. There is inescapably a relationship between water supply and quality of life. While America's non-renewable aquifers are exhausted, and while our great rivers are being totally diverted or sucked away, man-made oases that we have erected in deserts will resort to desert. Dust bowls will form once again. Agriculture will wither. Even municipalities will lose their water supply. A crucial fact, even today, there are regions of America where we are living off of water supplies collected and stored since the days of the dinosaurs. They are non-renewable. Of all the usable fresh water, all the fresh water that's ever been, that's how much we will have forever. There is no additional fresh water on the horizon. And it totals just 1% of all the water on Earth. That 1% sustains all living species, including 5 billion human lives on planet Earth every day. And by the year 2025, that same 1% must sustain all living species, including then 8 billion human lives. And yet, it is frightening how we squander water every minute. We dirty it, we dam it, we drain it, we divert it. Americans are the problem. We, you and I, must provide the leadership to prevent a certain disaster. After a two-year collaborative effort, the National Geographic Society, along with the Conservation Fund and the U.S. Geological Society, survey is sounding our wake-up alarm. Education must be the first step toward a better water ethic. So I'd like to begin with a geography lesson. As you likely know, some 70% of Earth's geography is water. So you might ask, what's the problem? Where's the shortage? Well, watch, and as my father-in-law says, listen up. I take this glass of water, and let's suppose that it represents all the water on planet Earth. So I can fill this glass of water almost to the top, and that's 97% of all the water in the Earth. And now I'm going to add the 3% of fresh water. But it's not that simple, because you see, 2% of that is ice locked up in the polar ice caps and the glaciers. It is unavailable to us. And so we finally get down to that water which we actually have access to. And that's it. There is no more. There never will be. fresh water on planet Earth is constant because it continuously passes through the stages of hydrologic cycle. It changes from water as we know it. It evaporates, it forms clouds, and it precipitates as rain and snow back to Earth. Some of it is soaked up to become groundwater. Those recycled few drops of fresh water supported people on Earth during biblical times. And you must remember that today we're depleting many of our aquifers much faster than they can be replenished. In some sections of the country, we are literally drawing down our children's future. Despite this, Americans squander water like it's an endless river. After all, there's always been an ample supply in most parts of the country. We turn on the tap and let it run. But surely there must be more to the story. And indeed, there is. When we started this project 2 years ago, we wanted to know in a scientific, quantitative way what Americans know and don't know about fresh water. We wanted to better understand their behavior and their attitudes toward fresh water. So we commissioned the respected Roper organization to conduct a benchmark national survey. Roper surveyed some 1,000 American adults and 291 youngsters aged 12 to 17 in June of this year. It is surprising how little awareness of water we found from that group of people. At the same time, we found some hopeful signs about fresh water. For example, some 75% said they wanted to and they indeed needed to know more about fresh water. Again, 75% considered freshwater pollution one of the most serious concerns facing the next generation. The majority said protecting fresh water should be a national priority. They said they are willing to invest their money to keep fresh water clean and available. Our writers, photographers, researchers, TV and radio producers joined scores of scientists to look into the topic of fresh water for these past 2 years. And we've learned many, many things. But the bottom line is that Americans squander water at an alarming rate. Waste and abuse occurs in all facets of our society, from American homes to billion-dollar projects approved by public officials. Let me cite a few examples. It takes 1,300 gallons of water a day to support our American standard of living. When you factor in water consumed for farming, industry, and cities, that's three times the average European consumption. The average American individual consumes about 100 gallons a day in his or her household. An average 10-minute shower uses half of that, some 50 gallons. Dishwashers take 15 gallons, and washing machines require 30 gallons. Now, on the other end of the scale, on the grand side, the mighty Mississippi River has been flowing vigorously for eons, and yet, in less than three generations, we have reduced the Colorado's flow into Mexico to a salty trickle, and today, the Colorado has long since died before it reaches the sea. Worldwide, similar water issues have ignited wars. In the Middle East, the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers come to mind. But we treat fresh water as if the well can't possibly run dry, despite aquifers and rivers that have already dried up. Next to oxygen, fresh water is indisputably the most precious resource on planet Earth. How did we get into such a mess? One reason is not hard to figure out. We take water for granted. Another reason is that water is artificially cheap. So cheap, we are not motivated to preserve it. Perhaps it's no surprise, then, that the goal of the 1972 Clean Water Act, that is, that all waters in the United States become fishable and swimmable by 1983, remains unmet 10 years after the target date. Because water is not valued monetarily, we continue to squander it. Going back to the energy issue, consider when oil prices skyrocketed from $4 a barrel to as high as $36 a barrel, we dramatically changed our consumption patterns. Now that oil prices have plummeted, our gas guzzling habits have returned. And with water, we have yet to experience that wake-up call. This nation uses some 339 billion gallons of fresh water in an average day, much of it because it's cheap and the supply is perceived to be endless. In the short term, it is not economical to invest in conservation. To try to put this in some kind of perspective, providing drinking water for this entire luncheon cost about one penny. On a larger scale, we have perfected the art of transporting water to wherever we want it to go, whether nature intended it to go there or not. Our massive systems for damming and diverting water ranks among the engineering achievements in human history. Results are both awe-inspiring and sometimes downright crazy. For example, we subsidize water-intensive crops in arid parts of the country, while at the same time we pay farmers in water-rich regions not to grow crops. And I promised I would not talk about growing rice in California. We have harnessed the mighty Columbia River to bring cheap electricity into the Pacific Northwest. But to do it, we have environmentally wrecked one of the world's great spawning grounds. Today, we literally carry baby salmon around dams and barges. And ironically, the very power generated by the Columbia River is consumed to transport water from the once mighty Colorado River into California. In Florida, we inefficiently water sugar fields, dairy farms, and expanding suburbs to the great benefit of Florida's economy. But in the process, we've drained the Everglades, which has caused 90% of its wading birds to disappear. We have created lush oases in stark environments like Las Vegas and Palm Springs. Are they water efficient? No, of course not. And when Las Vegas got thirsty last summer, officials considered buying desalinized water from Santa Barbara in a bizarre exchange with Los Angeles for their Colorado River allotment. And many people thought, sure, why not? We can do anything. And in the short run, maybe we can. But the cost to our health, to our economy, and particularly to our environment, continue to escalate every year. We must change. We must educate ourselves. The National Geographic Society has been educating people about the planet since 1888, but the $12 million that we have committed to fresh water is by far the most ambitious project that we have ever undertaken. We will harness the outreach of the entire National Geographic Society to its fullest. We will continue to seek public support for conservation, preservation, and an anti-pollution crusade. Never before have we marshaled our resources on one topic as we have fresh water to blitz the country with information in almost a simultaneous time frame. For example, you are aware that we published a special extra issue of National Geographic magazine on North American freshwater, along with a full-size map of freshwater in the United States. That in itself was a tremendous undertaking for the editorial staff. The USGS and the Conservation Fund provided expertise and tremendous assistance with that issue. And the special issue and map supplement are even now arriving in 9.6 million mailboxes around the world. National Geographic absorbed the entire cost as a public service effort. In addition, as you heard earlier, we produced for WETA PBS station a one-hour TV special to be aired tomorrow evening, November 10th, entitled The Power of Water. National Public Radio will broadcast a one-hour National Geographic NPR radio expedition called Water Thirsting for Tomorrow, beginning Saturday, November 13th. And perhaps our most important outreach, during the November 14th to 20th Geography Awareness Week, some 200,000 teachers nationwide will use classroom lesson plans we devised and mailed to them, thanks to a generous grant from Citibank. For 2 years, we have conducted water seminars for teachers from all 50 states. They are ready to move. Millions of American students then will learn about fresh water for one solid week. We at the Geographic are convinced that we have abused our fresh water to the point of a national emergency. If we act now, we can stave off a 1972 energy-like crisis. If we don't, America's fresh water will continue to decline with dire consequences. We must all commit ourselves to reasonable consumption, preservation, and conservation. And we keep coming back to those themes. To us at the Geographic, this water issue is so compelling because it mirrors the energy crisis 10 years before the calamity. 10 years of prudent planning will prevent a water disaster. Sadly, Americans, including the media, rarely respond to nonviolent early wake-up alarms. Most of us have no idea we are part of the problem. In fact, the Roper survey showed that the majority of Americans feel federal and state governments should protect fresh water. But only 37% think individuals should do more, despite a wide range of available opportunities for conservation and stewardship. In the case of water, what goes around truly comes around. We all share the blame for the current degradation of our fresh water. Hence, we must all share in a conservation and preservation crusade. There is good news. There's also hope for the future. As the Roper survey clearly showed, people want to help. They want to protect their water. They just must understand the geography of fresh water better and then be given some direction. President Kennedy once said, "In a democracy, everyone is an elected official." I'm convinced that if we educate the public on critical issues, public officials will be forced to make tough decisions. If we act today, we could still meet appropriate agricultural, municipal, and industrial needs. With better water management, we could be more selective in how we consume electricity. With careful planning, we won't have to decide between building airports or preserving wetlands. But we must act now to maintain our quality of life tomorrow. We must stop squandering water. We must preserve and conserve today so that our children will thrive tomorrow. And what's ahead? Well, at the National Geographic Society and the Conservation Fund, we are announcing today a forum on non-point source pollution. As you know, this includes runoff from streets, parking lots, lawns, and farms, which pollute our fresh water. Again, we must all share the responsibility. We have asked respected businesses, government, and nonprofit leaders to come together several times in 1994 to look for non-regulatory ways to address this major problem as it relates to fresh water. Governor John Engler of Michigan will chair the group. Governor Howard Dean of Vermont will co-chair. I'm also pleased to announce that Secretary Bruce Babbitt and EPA Administrator Carol Browner have agreed to join with us. We will keep you apprised of our progress. By 1994 year end, we will make recommendations for innovative policies and practices that we hope will improve water quality across the nation. As I mentioned earlier, half of Americans get their drinking water from the ground, yet more and more groundwater is being polluted. Unfortunately, once groundwater is polluted, it is almost impossible to clean it up because of the expense. As a result, we reduce that precious 1% supply even further. Some examples of how we pollute our fresh water. So many toxics pour into the Rio Grande on the Texas-Mexico border that some call it El Sur Grande. Nitrate used in fertilizers, as well as pesticides and industrial chemicals, are being detected in groundwater in the Middle West. Oil and gasoline, septic tank effluent, and pesticides have seeped into an aquifer beneath Long Island, a partial water supply for some 3 million people. It should be no surprise that 80% of the people surveyed by Roper felt that the main reason for protecting fresh water is for human health reasons. Let's hasten to say that there is some good news out there. In our special issue of National Geographic, there's a wonderful example of one woman who worked effectively to save a river. Her name, Marion Stoddard. 30 years ago, Marion began exploring the Nashua River in Massachusetts. The river had become so contaminated by dyes and other waste dumped into it that people wagered what color it might be from day to day. Sometimes red, sometimes orange, or it might even be blue. Pollutants actually discolored buildings black along the river. It was classified as unfit even to receive sewage. That's about as bad as it can get. Marion was so outraged that she launched a personal crusade to restore the Nashua River, to make it safe for swimming. By sheer determination, she mobilized everybody along the river to realize that they were part of a bigger system and to take responsibility for their part. In other words, she did it by thinking geographically, to consider an entire watershed. Today, because Marion Stoddard had vision, tenacity, and the ability to motivate people, she succeeded. Today, the Nashua River runs clear enough to swim in it again. Small miracles like this are happening today in hundreds of communities across America. wherever determined and caring people know their geography and recognize that water is part of a vast system linking us to each other and to life itself. It is said that a weakness of this nation is that it takes a crisis to move us into action. But our great strength, I think, is that once galvanized, we can solve almost any problem. Today, I hope the nation hears our wake-up alarm. America must understand that we have a potential disastrous water crisis. This is the moment to stop squandering the resource. It is up to each of us as individuals to do our part the way Marion Stoddard did. Now is the time to take action to protect and preserve all the water that we'll ever get for ourselves and for future generations. The challenge is to each of us. Thank you very much.
Some of this is yours.
That's all right. You'll be asking questions
okay.
Here, and I'll pass them to you. Since 1980, water use has dropped somewhat. Is this encouraging or just a result of the recession?
Oh, I think any drop in water consumption is encouraging. The wonderful thing about the water issue is that if we conserve and be reasonable, we can provide for the future. And that's one of the attractive aspects of this crusade. We can be successful. This is not a doomsday project. And the fact that we have reduced water consumption in some areas is very encouraging. It's just the beginning.
You talked briefly about the survey that was conducted. Could you tell us some of the key findings of the survey and their significance?
Well, I have the best one in the world to tell you about that survey, and I'd like to ask Bud Roper if he would care to participate.
Actually, and Mr. Grosvenor's talk was a much broader ranging talk than just the survey, but he did comment on the significant findings. Let me focus on the survey and try and pull those together. Our survey showed that both the nation's adults and young people are quite concerned and quite willing, but quite uninformed and currently doing very little. They're quite concerned about both the quality and quantity of our water, particularly the quality. They're quite willing to do what they can if instructed. We asked about 11 different actions that people could take and pointed out to half the sample what the costs were. And we got the same results regardless of whether we mentioned costs or not. Majority approval of 9 of the 11 measures. But people are quite, when I say people are quite uninformed, they're uninformed as to how much water they use and how much individual appliances or uses consume. When I say they're doing very little, way under half are turning off the water when they brush their teeth, or limiting the number of flushes on the toilet, or limiting the amount of watering of their lawns they do. Now there's a fifth finding which flows from all of this, and that is that the public feels it needs to know more about water and is receptive to the education that Mr. Grosvenor is talking about. Those would be the principal findings.
When talking about your pollution forum, you mentioned non-regulatory approaches. Is this realistic, and could you expand on this?
Yes, I think it's realistic. I think that public opinion has a very powerful role to play in the politics of fresh water. I think if it became the established thing to do, if the voters decided that public officials should take an interest in fresh water, I dare say they would do it instantly. And that, to me, is why we should educate people about fresh water. Education will clearly lead to conservation, preservation, better stewardship of fresh water and our environment in general. But we have to educate the public. They have to exercise the power of the vote.
Is your special panel, including the governors and the cabinet secretaries, bipartisan, or are people divided by party lines on this issue?
I do not believe they're divided by party lines. The forum is bipartisan. Our aim, as it usually is to keep politics out of the issue as much as we can. We want to bring the American people into the issue. We want them to participate in this crusade.
You say that we take fresh water for granted because it's not highly valued. Are you advocating higher prices for water?
I suppose if I wanted to compete with NAFTA and the others today, I would say yes. but I think that we should judge water as a much more valuable commodity than it is. Today, we are not motivated economically to improve our efficiency in the consumption of water. If it takes price, that's what will eventually happen, whether we like it or not. It happened with oil. It'll happen with water. I'm advocating addressing the issue before it addresses us. And if we do that, then money and cost won't control the crusade. People should control this crusade. We should make the decision that we want to address this before it addresses us.
Speaking of NAFTA, do you think environmental provisions in NAFTA are adequate to improve the deplorable water quality conditions in Mexico that your project has documented?
Well, I think that I come down on the side of the environmentalists in general on this one. I would certainly push hard to make stewardship of the environment and cleaning up of the rivers a high priority in any international agreement, anywhere. I think that it is a very strong weapon to use to clean up an environment, particularly when it crosses international borders.
What specific steps can each American take to conserve water right now, and what can businesses do to conserve water and make employees more conscious of water problems?
We have in our kit several ideas on how you can, as individuals, reduce your water consumption. Some of them sound so simple that you'll laugh at them. One of them is turning off the water tap. That's not terribly difficult, and it isn't going to change your quality of life. Instead of taking a 10-minute shower, take a 5-minute shower. Instead of filling the bathtub to the brim, fill it 5 inches from the bottom, just have 5 inches of water. Sprinkle your lawns more efficiently. Do it early in the morning or late at night if you have to do it at all. Soak the water in the ground, into the ground, but water less frequently. I know in my own house I built a very elaborate sprinkler system 7-8 years ago, and now I've got to tear it apart and retrofit it with energy saving devices, which are on the market today, and I can reduce my water supply by maybe as much as a couple 100%.
Do you expect that your project will result in new legislation dealing with protecting water resources? And where would you like Congress to begin on this issue if that's true?
We're not aiming this issue at Congress, but we did send a copy of the issue to every congressman. I think that I would like to see Congress seriously address the Clean Water Act again and hopefully come forth with some bill that's favorable for the environment. I would like to see congressmen themselves practice water conservation. I guess I would be the most happy if I had a teenager come home and criticize a senator for not being water conscious in his or her own home. I think that that would send a message. I have great faith in the American teachers in this country. There are 200,000 teachers out there that I guarantee you are going to pump as much information as they can in the youngsters on how to conserve water in their home. They'll have little pamphlets on how to do that. They'll take them home, and dad and mom are going to have to heed to the message. I think that's a powerful group. That group also will grow up one day to be a senator and perhaps have a little clearer understanding of water issues. So, again, I'm more interested in education. I'm interested in voter education because I think that's what's going to ultimately drive Congress.
I understand that the environmental community, industry, and the EPA are working at a compromise for specifics of the Clean Water Act. What is your take on the outlook of the regulatory negotiations? Will a compromise be reached?
Well, Old Man River keeps rolling along. I'll believe it when I see it. I hope they do work out a compromise agreement that's favorable for the environment, but we'll just have to wait and see. Congress has got a lot on its plate right now, and I've lived here long enough to realize I would be a fool to estimate what Congress is going to do.
Okay, we got several questions on desalinization. You haven't mentioned the need to improve and expand our technology to desalinate water. How much do you estimate it would cost the U.S. to improve our technology, and can we afford it?
One of the reasons I'm anxious to start right away is because I don't think in the foreseeable future we have to go to desalinization as a national objective. I think we have adequate water supplies if we husband them carefully. If we build desalinization plants, you're just going to some kind of destroy the environment, particularly the atmospheric environment. And you're going to destroy it because we just won't discipline ourselves to conserve what we have. So to me, desalinization is not the answer to the problem in the United States. The answer is conservation, preservation.
Another scheme that was tried was towing icebergs from the polar regions. What are the prospects of that?
They ran aground in the South Pacific. That one I never took very seriously. There was a time when which I thought was rather ironic, the Saudis were going to use their oil money to tow water to Saudi Arabia. Actually, what they've done, of course, is they have gone deep for groundwater. The Saudis now are pumping huge amounts of water to grow wheat in the desert. They're not only self-sufficient, but they've become a major player in international wheat markets, but it is an unsustainable agricultural scheme. But it shows you to what great lengths somebody will go to who's thirsty.
Does your study discuss the trend toward bottled water? and the environmental costs associated with that.
Americans must be coming more and more concerned about their water because they consumed some 2 billion bottles of water last year. I sometimes wonder if they didn't come in one tap and out the other. But clearly, if somebody in New York City is going to pay $5 for a bottle of water, the situation has gotten serious, and I think you're going to see more and more people turning to that as water becomes brackish, as it becomes deteriorated, as the fear of pollution in groundwater continues. I suspect if I lived under an aquifer where you could light it on fire, that I also would buy bottled water.
Is our collective water treatment system adequate? What needs to be built for the next century, or do we need new technology, not more water treatment systems?
I think that from what I know, and I'm not an expert on that we are doing a better job in many areas of the country in treating our water. That said, there's still municipalities that are basically ducking the issue and dumping almost raw sewage into major rivers. Rio Grande is one. And I think that it is not an issue that's pervasive across the country. Every municipality is different. Some are excellent and some are terrible. Hopefully, public opinion will force those that are terrible to clean up their act. And it will cost some more money, but let me tell you, if we don't conserve and preserve, the cost of water will become a major budgetary item.
Does the water issue signal a new activist stance by the Geographic? And if so, how do you reconcile that with the organization's educational status?
We were very careful to structure our entire water crusade to be one of education, not confrontation. I'm not opposed to confrontation, but that's not what we're about, the National Geographic Society. We believe in education. We believe in publishing as honest and as straight a story as we can. We try not to slant it. And as a result, we know we have, among all Americans, a 90% confidence rating. That is quite high in today's world. And I think the reason we have it is because our readers and Americans know that we really attempt to publish facts. And we've tried to do that as much as we can in the water issue. We're not perfect. We probably made mistakes. But the intention was to make this crusade one of education, not confrontation.
Speaking as someone who makes his living from printing, I'd like to ask you this question. What's the status of paper printing technology? Has that improved? Or does it still damage the environment by having chlorine, et cetera, in the wastewater that's produced?
Well, as you all know, the paper industry is a very highly regulated industry. They started cleaning up their rivers decades ago. And some of their statistics are pretty impressive. For example, in 1985, the paper industry set a goal of 1995 to recycle 40% of its paper. It has met that goal in 1993. It's cost them $7.5 billion for plant additions and renovations, but they've done it, and they did it a couple of years early, and they're setting even higher standards now for recycling paper. In the area of chlorine and dioxin, the paper industry last year produced a total of four ounces, all the paper companies, measurable 4 ounces of dioxin, which is something like 1% of the natural and industrial supply production of toxin nationwide. They've worked hard to do that. It's cost them a lot of money. But if you take the top 10 paper companies or mills in the United States, you cannot detect dioxin in their effluent. So they've made great strides there. In energy consumption, over the past 10 years through cogeneration, they have reduced their outside energy needs by some 87%. In the area of water consumption, they've reduced their need for water by more than 50% per ton in the last 10 years. So I think that the paper industry as a whole is doing a pretty good job. But you'll find isolated examples of where they're doing a terrible job. And hopefully we're not buying paper from companies that are not environmentally conscious. And if everybody takes that position, you'll find that paper company will either clean up or go bankrupt. And it's effective.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for speaking here today.
Thank you very much.
A book, Herb Block, A Cartoonist's Life, by National Press Club member Herbert Block, signed by the author.
Thank you.
And the National Press Club mug.
Oh. Thank you very much.
The final question is, now that all of us sitting here have drained our water glasses, and this drinking water comes from the Potomac, what can you tell us about what we just drank?
Well, I tried my best to have them not serve you water today. But the Potomac River is interesting. I can remember when I came back to Washington from college in the 50s, early 60s, I like to race sailboats. You wouldn't catch me dead on a boat in the Potomac. Actually, I probably would have been dead if I had gotten on a boat in the Potomac River. And I can remember I tried it once, and I put my boat in the water. And this is a true story. That water was so polluted that I couldn't tell when my boat was aground. There was so much junk in that river that it sounded like my centerboard was scraping on the bottom. And today, I'll take my 12-year-old, and we'll go fishing in the Potomac. We did that just a couple of weeks ago. He caught a huge catfish. I confess to say I didn't eat it. I threw it back for conservation reasons. But I think the Potomac River has been cleaned up dramatically in the last 15, 20 years. So if the water was properly treated when it came out of the Potomac, it should be in pretty good shape. I've been drinking it for 62 years. I'm still alive, I think.